Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 4th of September 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. Just in time delivery.
I think so, with a couple of seconds late, actually. But anyway, yesterday we obviously were talking about military unification quite a lot, and the fact that the British military were arriving at a certain place with EU flags on their shoulders, and also in another video clip where there was a video of British officers saluting the EU national anthem, and as opposed to, there's no mention of the UK national anthem there. But anyway, here we are with the image of the EU flag on the arm of a paratrooper from the UK. Well, apparently our coverage yesterday...
It's made an impact.
It seems to have, because the Ministry of Defence publishes this every day, Defence in the Media. And if we scroll on down to the bottom of this page, we find that they chose an image of the day from the same exercise, the arrival of the troops in Bosnia. But they chose to photograph the troops from the other direction, so that we see their left arms rather than the right arms.
Yep.
And what we see, Brian, is that the Union Jack badge, which is absolutely almost invisible in this image, is only a fraction of the size on their left arms of the EU flag on their right arms. But nonetheless, I'm pleased to see the Ministry of Defence clearly feeling a little bit sensitive about it and feeling that they needed to push this this image out. They were pushing it out on Twitter as well. So yes, there we go.
It's very good. People are asking for good news, and this sort of thing is good news because it's showing the power of social media. But to be fair, on this particular image, Veterans Today also Veterans for Britain also picked up on this and has done some really good work pushing it out. It's now started a move around. We know that there are an increasing number of ex-military people paying attention. There's also senior officers who are waking up to the fact that this military unification is going ahead. We'll just pick this off the internet. Well, somebody sent it through to us. So here was Political UK seeing the same thing. They've got the badge highlighted. Obviously, this is exactly what you're talking about, Mike. The view from the right hand. The right-hand shoulder shows the EU flag very clearly. So here we are with the headline, British Army troops are being forced to wear the EU flag on their uniform. And this is where it's very, very interesting because Veterans from Britain now starting to do some really excellent reporting on this and other matters to do with this EU military unification. But they say this: while UK forces have participated in training missions which are not forces under the EU flag, subordinate to EU common security and defence policy, and answerable to the MPCC, which is EU's military planning and conduct capability, we have never previously been involved in Euro forces at this level of commitment and readiness. Only last year did UK ministers make it possible for UK troops to serve under EU military command and control.
Yes.
So at the very time, Theresa May's government telling us that that we're coming out of the European Union, what we're actually doing in the background is putting our troops fully under EU control. I just wanted that one paused on screen because I added a little headline that there, meet Team Juncker, EU's private army. Why have I put that at the top of this particular slide? Well, let's come in with an image that was sent through to us. So here we've got the European Commission building with a huge banner on it. It's on the right-hand side of the building, huge building. If we highlight this little bit at the top, it actually says hashtag Team Juncker EU. I think that would be better put as hashtag Team Junk EU. But nevertheless, we've now got Team Juncker boasting that they're now controlling large sections of the British military. So this is serious stuff, but it's taken alternative media to bring it to the public's attention.
Okay, let's move over to Syria then. And Donald Trump tweeting this out earlier. President Bashar al-Assad of Syria must not recklessly attack Idlib province. The Russians and Iranians would be making a grave humanitarian mistake to take part in this potential human tragedy. Hundreds of thousands of people could be killed. Don't let it happen. Well, there we go. President Trump concerned about the lives of terrorists in northern Syria and saying that this would be a humanitarian disaster. Now, to be honest, Brian, you know, I didn't know what was going on here. And, well, you and I both noticed the BBC covering this. Why does the battle for Idlib matter? Because, you know, I'm really glad for this. If they hadn't published this article, I wouldn't have known what was going on.
Well, I think that's unlikely, Mike, but there we go. Yes, an incredible article for the BBC. The subject is obviously Syria, but the important thing to notice as we go through this analysis is if the BBC can do this over Syria, they're doing it to every piece of news they've got. So we've labelled this BBC propaganda, terrorists become rebels to help undermine Assad and the Russians. Now, the BBC have done this many times before, but we thought we'd take a look in depth at this particular article to see just how pernicious their fakery is of reporting the news. It's got to appalling level, really. So let's bring it in. We've taken some paragraphs out of this article, or some sentences at least. So here we've got the province. They're talking about Idlib is the last major stronghold of the rebel and jihadist groups, which have been trying to overthrow Mr. Assad for the past 7 years. So we start off with getting the word rebel. These are just rebels. They're rebelling against Mr. Assad. They're freedom fighters. Nothing to worry about. If Idlib is taken by the government, it would leave the rebels with a few pockets of territory scattered across the country and effectively signal their final defeat. So in the readers' minds, the BBC is ramming home that these are freedom fighters, they're rebels, and they're going to be defeated by that nasty Mr. Assad. Well, later in the article, it's got this sub-headline, Who Controls Idlib? Where the BBC says the province is not controlled by a single group, but rather a number of rival factions commanding up to an estimated 30,000 fighters. So we've got rebels, we've got fighters.
At no point is the word terrorist
used. Terrorists not mentioned at all. But then we get something interesting. The dominant force is Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, a jihadist alliance linked to al-Qaeda. So al-Qaeda, which of course a few years ago was the vicious terrorist force which was going to kill all of us in our beds, was a threat to every single Western country. We've now got the BBC finally admitting that it's this level of terrorists which is controlling the forces in the Idlib province. They go on to say HTS controls key locations across Idlib, including the provincial capital and the Bab el-Hawaya border crossing with Turkey. It's designated as a terrorist organisation by the UN, which estimates it has 10,000 fighters in Idlib, including many foreigners. So the facts that the BBC finally manages to introduce show us very clearly that in Idlib we're dealing with terrorist control. These are vicious people who've done despicable things, despicable atrocities. But the BBC has opened its reporting by calling them effectively rebels. And then we get the real meat of this, because the article says that according to the UN, Idlib is home to some 2.9 million people, including 1 million children. More than half of the civilians in Idlib come from other previously rebel-held parts of Syria, from which they either fled or evacuated. So here's the BBC putting this vicious twist in. It's admitted that the controlling force in Idlib are vicious terrorists, but then the people have come from rebel-held parts. They haven't run to Idlib because they were trying to escape from terrorism in Syria. No, no, no. They've fled, and the implication is, of course, they've fled from Assad's forces.
And of course, no mention. They do say there that they were evacuated. No mention of the circumstances of that evacuation. The fact that in other so-called rebel-held areas, the terrorists were allowed to leave with their families and their weapons, and they mostly went to Idlib.
No mention of that at all, Mike. No. And of course, there's no mention of who wrote this article. This is another one of the BBC's articles where if you ask them who wrote this article, you get the utterly arrogant response from the BBC. You don't need to know. It's come from the BBC. Therefore, you can trust what it says. So the fact is that 2.9 million Syrian people are ruled by terrorists in Idlib, but the BBC does not want to admit that because, of course, that would start to reinforce the case as to why Assad and the Russians need to remove these terrorists. Now, the other thing the BBC doesn't put together in the picture is the type of reporting they're doing. Well, obviously, they're not going to admit what they're doing here. But in the image we've got here, we're basically talking about the Russians wanting to liquidate the terrorists. And I found this particularly interesting because if the West kills terrorists, that's good. Boris Johnson and Cameron and others were very quick to say that these terrorists could be killed, drone attack or whatever. But dead terrorists, that was effectively good. But if it's Syria and Russia killing terrorists, then the BBC thinks that this is clearly very bad. And what we're looking at here, this is straight out of Animal Farm. This is a complete reversal of truth and facts to produce this propaganda.
Well, of course, the reason that when Syria and Russia kill terrorists is bad is because, of course, there are terrorists. We paid for them. And so it would be bad to kill our terrorists. But anyway, the other thing in that article that I wanted to mention, Brian, was the question later on in the article was what will happen to the people living in Idlib? And it said a full-scale military operation could have devastating consequences in the province. Hundreds of thousands of people there are already experiencing dire conditions in overcrowded sites where basic services have been stretched to breaking point. Okay, like Gaza, for example, perhaps, although somewhat different circumstances, but, you know, it's terrible that it's happening in Idlib, but it's not so terrible that it's happening in Gaza. But you'll notice that they don't mention Raqqa and they don't mention Mosul, because the implication in what they're saying is that a full-scale military operation would have devastating consequences because of the number of, quote, civilians in the area, in the region. Well, you know, we can't mention Raqqa, Mosul, because those were operations that we ran where we indiscriminately bombed and lots of civilians were killed and injured. But that's OK when we do it, but it's not OK whenever the Syrian army carries out targeted strikes, which are deliberately intended not to kill civilians. That's not OK.
It's not OK, because it's good for us to do it, but it's bad for anybody else to do it, Mike. And I just thought we could remind viewers of the sorts of reports that have appeared in British press over the last couple of years. So here we've got David Cameron. It is Britain's duty to attack ISIS in Syria. The PM says MPs must decide whether to take on evil or wait for attacks on Britons. Jeremy Corbyn replies that innocent civilians will be killed. Interesting, we'll be coming on to Mr. Corbyn a little bit later in the news, but at least he was there applying some common sense and warning what was going to happen. But Cameron, of course, no, it's our moral duty to get into Syria killing terrorists. And the BBC themselves, of course, reported this. So we've got this blistering hypocrisy by the British government and, of course, the BBC, which is simply the government's propaganda arm. You've hit the nail on the head, though, Mike, because, of course, the other thing that the BBC is absolutely not reporting is the fact that now areas of Syria are being liberated. What's coming to the surface is the evidence of thousands of tons of Western ammunition and munitions. And you've got to go onto YouTube and see other sources than mainstream to actually see the scale of what's been uncovered. I've just taken a few stills from some of the videos. People can easily find these online. But here we've got boxes and boxes. It can be everything from mortar ammunition to rocket-propelled grenades to large-scale caliber machine gun ammunition. Everything is there. And this is all produced by the West, much of it produced, of course, in America. So it's not just from one source. We've got a lot here. And this is a debate on Press TV about these munitions and how they were supplied. And of course, we have people speaking up from America also saying that our government, i.e. the US government, is fully guilty in what's going on. This is actually a drone footage which shows a vast area where all of this ammunition and munitions has been laid out. I've just circled a man taking some video there to give you a some indication of scale, but basically this is all munitions from the West supplied to terrorists who we then claim to know nothing about. And of course, 3.74 billion propaganda machine of the BBC simply will not report any of this information. But I'm pleased to say that people are picking up on this. This was sent through to us. So it's a gentleman called Charles Shoebridge, and he's saying the same US that led the destruction and carnage of Mosul and Raqqa and turns a blind eye to civilian suffering inflicted by US allies in Gaza and Yemen now warns Syria not to recklessly free Idlib from rebels who even the BBC says are mostly Al-Qaeda. So the good news, again, is that we've got members of the public clearly seeing through this horrendous propaganda from the BBC.
Right, let's come back to the UK then. And if anybody's been paying attention to Ian Crane's morning live streams, you'll know that, 5G has been on his agenda. And, good news, because the British government has announced that the West Midlands Regional Authority is to become the first UK large-scale 5G testbed. So this is Birmingham, Coventry and Wolverhampton to become 5G hubs after winning a national competition. So they've been selected to become the first testbed. This is part of the Urban Connected Communities project. It's the next step in the government's 5G testbed and trials programme, and it's going to develop a large-scale 5G pilot across the region. With hubs in Birmingham, Coventry and Wolverhampton, as I say, £50 million currently available for the project, including £25 million from the Department for Culture, Digital Culture, Media and Sport. And on screen there, we've got our current digital minister talking about this, Margot James. And of course, this is on top of a whole host of money already and projects already mentioned, including 5G Rural First, 5G Smart Tourism, the Worcestershire 5G Consortium, Liverpool 5G Testbed, Auto Air, and so on. So a whole host of other projects already announced. So government really pressing ahead with this. Now, I'm quite interested in that, Brian, because if we recall the rollout of 2G, 3G and 4G mobile technology in this country, particularly the 3G rollout, the government had quite a different role in that, and in fact, many of the telecoms companies complaining about the amount of money that they had to spend in order to obtain licenses for use of the 3G spectrum. The situation is completely different with 5G for some reason. Many people could speculate as to why that is, but there's plenty of people commenting on it, and I do suggest that people sort of pay attention to this issue and do a bit of research on it. Why is the government so keen to roll out this particular technology? I think it's quite interesting that they've changed their role here.
Yeah, and we are asking for help from our viewers and listeners on this, because aside from people who've specialised in reporting on 5G, we're very, very interested as to what people are seeing on the ground. So if you're in the Birmingham area, for example, and you've got information or you've got photographs of some of the equipment, we'd like to have some of that information so that we can rebroadcast it.
Okay, so modern slavery, we've been talking about that for quite some time. Well, you know, our illustrious Prime Minister in Africa at the moment, but so is Penny Mordaunt. And so in Nigeria, they are going to stop modern slavery. This is really impressive. So UK aid is going to protect thousands of vulnerable men, women and children in Nigeria from modern slavery and unsafe migration through innovative prevention work. They're going to tackle the root causes of dangerous migration and modern slavery. And they're going to do all kinds of amazing things to prevent this from happening in the future. They're going to help reduce vulnerabilities to trafficking and unsafe migration through targeted public information campaigns. So that's great. They're going to boost engagement with young people at schools and universities to change their aspirations. They're going to commission innovative research in what works to prevent dangerous migration attempts. And they're going to support NGOs who use former modern slavery victims to counter false myths that tempt people towards the traffickers. So this is fantastic stuff. They're investing £6 million in the Stamping Out Slavery in Nigeria program, which is going to take that to £10 million in total. Of course, the total budget that they've got for anti-slavery activities is £150 million. And so on. So what did Penny Mordaunt have to say? She said, it is a necessity that we step up and stamp out modern slavery for good. I'm appalled that this shameful stain on our global conscience still exists in the 21st century. Of course you are, Penny, because there's no money at all in this. We've highlighted this many, many times. £130 billion is the profit that's made every year from human trafficking and modern slavery. And we can see there the types of activities that people are forced into, 54% into sexual exploitation, 38% into forced labour, 8% into others. Now, what's interesting here is, as I said, the overall budget for the government to deal with this is £150 million. And you need to set that against the £130 billion in profit that's made from this. But the other government statistic that I thought was interesting is that modern day slavery costs the UK £4.3 billion a year. So that's money that's spent in terms of policing, but it's also money that's spent in terms of victim care and rehabilitation. So that's money that's being given to charities and NGOs to look after the victims, the few victims that end up back in the care system, in some sort of care system. So this is this is all pretty shocking. Now, of course, what is one of the main countries that forms a main trafficking route for victims of modern slavery and human trafficking? Well, of course, it's Libya. So here we have the BBC reporting hundreds escape Libyan prison amid deadly clashes in Tripoli. And I just wanted to highlight a comment that Neil Clark made on this this morning, that Libya had the highest human development index in the whole of Africa and was hailed by the Daily Telegraph as one of the top cruise ship destinations in the world in 2010, the year before NATO's liberal intervention. Now look at it, and he's highlighting this BBC article. Libya has become one of the main routes for trafficking human beings. Well, we don't seem to worry too much about that because we created that problem. We're spending a pittance on solving the problem. We're continuing to not allow countries to develop economically, which would prevent this from happening in the first place. And we're driving the people out of their countries in sub-Saharan Africa through terrorism and other activities that, we seem to be supporting. So I'm not quite clear what Penny Mordaunt's on. But this is not going to make any difference whatsoever other than continue to develop the market, perhaps.
I would say so. And of course, to give some people at least the impression that something good is happening whilst they carry on causing the problem in the first place. Well, we return to the BBC because, of course, the BBC has been very quick to pick up on the anti-Semitism bandwagon at the moment, and BBC piling in the articles on problems within Labour, particularly pointing a finger at Jeremy Corbyn and saying, essentially that we've now got this incredible problem with anti-Semitism in UK. But in this interesting article, they went in deeper to warn us, really, that it's not just anti-Semitism, but it's also anti-Zionism. Either of those two areas and you're going to be in big trouble. You're certainly going to be in big trouble if you're somebody in politics.
Are they suggesting that these are the same thing?
Well, let's just have a look at how that pans out. I just checked on BBC Twitter to see what they were talking about. So plastics were very big. That's encouraging. Never mind sexual exploitation, but the BBC big on plastics at the moment. And they're advertising their latest feminine comedy, which is the woman there. But under that, we're straight back into anti-Semitism, particularly vile little video, certainly bad language in it. But a number of people standing up and claiming that they've been victim of anti-Semitism, or anti-Semitism is on the rise. And I believe one lady points out that, of course, Jewish communities have now had to create their own effectively police forces in order to guarantee their security. I haven't seen any discussion as to whether this is actually legal, really, but it's interesting to think that we've more or less got private police forces operating at the moment.
I wonder what would happen if Islamic communities were to provide their own police forces. There would be somewhat of a larger outcry on
that. I think there would be an outcry. Well, in the BBC article, this man gets mentioned, Lord Levy. He has to say this: there can be criticism of the state of Israel, but anti-Semitism, using the word Zionist as another form of anti-Semitism, frankly can no longer be tolerated. So this is a brilliant statement, because we've got two completely different subjects. He links them together and then says, well, if you're talking about criticising Zionist policy, but you're really being anti-Semitic, then we can't tolerate this. Mm. So who's to decide whether somebody is being that devious, or could it just be now that if you dare to say something which is against Zionist politics, you're automatically to be described as being anti-Semitic? Mm. So I've labelled this that basically criticism of Israel is permitted when the Jewish community says it is.
Well, certain elements of the Jewish community.
Elements, exactly. Now, an image which I wanted to put up, but unfortunately I couldn't get it just in time for the news, is that the BBC did include in their article a picture of Orthodox Jews who were themselves protesting against Zionist policies. And I think this is one of the few times that I've actually seen the BBC admitting that there are many, many people in the Jewish community who are themselves very, very worried about political policies that are coming in under the banner of Zionism. Mm. But nevertheless, the BBC, right into the heart of and the anti-Semitism debate, and they are clearly targeting Mr. Corbyn and the Labour Party. But if we go back a bit, it gets quite interesting. This is a report from 2017 from the Mail. Mystery deepens over Blair's secret talks with a Labour donor calling for a breakaway party as it emerges former PM's Downing Street fundraiser, Lord Cashpoint, that's Lord Levy, joined the meeting. And this was the meat of it. Mr. Blair and Lord Levy, dubbed Lord Cashpoint when he was Blair's Downing Street fundraiser, travelled to Hull last month for discussions with Dr. Asem Alam, who was offered to fund moderate Labour MPs who want to leave Jeremy Corbyn's Labour and set up a new centrist party. Dr. Alam, 77, the owner of Hull City Football Club, who's given a mere £720,000 to Labour, said that during the meeting he had offered to give Mr. Blair several million pounds to boost the centre-left. So now we've got something very interesting happening, because we're clearly seeing the power of Lord Levy, at least, together with these relatively unknown, very wealthy donors, to put money in to change the whole structure of Britain's political landscape, and in particular to undermine the Labour Party.
The name Dr. Asem Alam does not seem like a Jewish name to me. So this therefore seems like this is broader than just a Jewish attempt to undermine Corbyn and set up an alternative Labour Party. So we've got a very senior member of the Jewish community in Lord Levy. We've got Tony Blair, whatever he is. And we've got Dr. Asim Alam. This seems to be beyond religion or culture or...
Yes.
Yes.
It's very interesting. I think what we're starting to... We could label it the deep state, but we're starting to look at people. We don't really know who they are, what their allegiances are, what their belief structure is. What we can say is that they're all connected to vast amounts of money, and that money is being used to steer British politics, whatever the British people think should be happening in the political agenda. Mm. And I just want to add into this, though, that it's been the UK column alone that has been warning and warning about the Conservative government's linking up of our intelligence services and GCHQ through to organisations in Israel, including universities, but including the police in Israel and the Israeli Defence Force Unit 8200, which is really an Israeli equivalent of GCHQ. All of this has been linked together without any debate in Westminster or any real consultation with the British public. So why is this happening? We've our ideas, but we're interested to know what our viewers and listeners think. Could it be that the state of Israel has excessive influence on politics in Britain?
Now, yesterday we mentioned Sajid Javid making it his personal mission to deal with child sexual exploitation online. And I suggested that perhaps there was a bit more to this than meets the eye, because let's face it, the British government for many, many years, many political hues, hasn't exactly felt that this was a subject that they particularly needed to deal with. So they're going to keep children safe online. And as we made the point yesterday, Sajid Javid said that he was absolutely shocked. He's telling us that at the scale of the potential for abuse of children online. And so he had said that all technology companies had to step up their efforts to tackle online sexual exploitation. And that was the result of this figure of 80,000 people in the UK presenting some kind of sexual threat to children online, and a 700% increase in child abuse images being referred to the National Crime Agency. But he said that while he was pleased at the efforts of online platforms to tackle online extremism following the government's calls for them to do that a couple of years ago, that really they needed to do something about this issue as well. Well, as I say, this seemed very fishy to me, because the government has done absolutely nothing in this area in the past. But we don't need to worry, because not only at the same time Sajid Javid was making this statement and saying that the social media companies and the big online companies needed to do something about this. Well, Google just had a press release ready to go. Just a pure coincidence, Brian. It wasn't staged in any way, shape or form. They just had this ready to go, this announcement, which took place about the same time Sajid Javid was making his. And they're saying that that they are going to use AI to help organisations detect and report child sexual abuse material online. So this is a new free tool that they're offering to service providers, NGOs and other technology companies, which is going to be able to review content at scale using deep neural networks for image processing. They can now assist reviewers sorting through the many images by prioritising those that are most likely to contain child sexual abuse material so that they can review those. So that's good. So Javid had said that he wanted technology companies to stop child grooming taking place on their platforms. He said he wanted them to work with government and law enforcement to shut down live streaming child abuse. He wanted companies to be much more forward-leaning to help law enforcement agencies to deal with these types of crimes. And he said that he wanted them to show a greater level of openness and transparency and a willingness to share best practice and technology between companies. So, if you were taking this problem seriously, those suggestions are probably quite useful. But I maintain a healthy scepticism. But now the other item that he mentioned on his list was this, that he expected technology companies to block child sexual abuse material as soon as companies detect it being uploaded. And this one stuck out for me because, of course, this is identical to the EU's Copyright Directive, Article 11 of that, which failed to pass in July, which was all about the ability for technology companies to scan content as it's being uploaded to their platforms and automatically censor content that they didn't feel was appropriate. Now, of course, I'm by no means suggesting that child sexual abuse material is appropriate to upload. But of course, this is about implementing or finding an excuse to implement certain types of technologies. And as I just reiterate the point that at no point in the last 30 years has the British government done anything to deal with this issue. And suddenly now we're dealing with it by implementing policies and implementing technologies which aren't really going to make a huge amount of difference to the people that are perpetrating these crimes, but are going to make a huge amount of difference to us, because what this means is that all material being uploaded to these platforms is being scanned with, under the cover of being scanned for the purposes of identifying this material. But what else was going on today? Well, Cressida Dick, the police commissioner for the Metropolitan Police, said vital evidence in criminal investigations held by tech and social media firms should be made available to the police in minutes. So, in other words, what we're building here under the... This is a pretty cynical effort, I think, by Sajid Javid to build the police state using child sexual abuse as the excuse,
as a way of levering in the censorship.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I'll just say once again, the British government has done nothing on this issue. And, you know, I have to say I'm staggered that the various police authorities are able to offer any statistics on this. Suddenly we've got this big statistic of 80,000 people and a 700% increase. Because one thing that we have been flagging up over the last number of years is how statistics with respect to child abuse and children in care and so on, these statistics are impossible to find because they're not held. So how they magic these up for this purpose is another question that I'd like an answer to.
A very interesting one. If we might pop the lovely Cressida Dick back on screen there, Mike. I read this. It makes me wince. Vital evidence in criminal investigations held by tech and social media firms should be made available in minutes. For what? Because, Miss Dick, when one of your own policemen, John Wedger, came forward with his evidence that children, the abuse of children, children dying, was being covered up by the Met Police, by MPs, by local authorities and charities, your force did absolutely nothing with that evidence. In fact, they attacked John Wedger and bullied him, threatened him, put him on half pay, stopped his pay. So this was all on the watch of Cressida Dick, and yet she's now standing up to threaten internet companies that you better produce this information. Presumably she wants the information to help close it down, as was done with John Wedger. I better stop at that point because I could say a lot more. One thing I will say is that it's becoming clear that something is getting very sticky within the so-called child abuse investigation currently underway. We know that there's been some discussions between the investigation, ICSA and Westminster. It appears that people in very senior positions are getting very, very squeamish because more and more evidence keeps coming forward to that inquiry that senior members of the political establishment have been involved in the abuse of children. And I think Westminster at the moment knows that there is a storm coming. It doesn't quite know how to deal with it. Perhaps some of our viewers and listeners will also have noticed that the trial case for the child abuse whistleblower under the name Nick has all gone quiet. Now, Nick was going to be prosecuted for, and with that, it's gone straight out of my head. He was accused of basically making public part of investigations, perjury. And that has now suddenly gone quiet. Why is this? Well, we don't know for certain, but we believe it's because more evidence is coming to the surface, possibly suggesting that what he had to say was correct. We know there's trouble inside the child abuse inquiry. And thank you very much to the person who pointed us at this today. Now, this is part of the BBC Reality Check website. The headline is, "What do you want BBC Reality Check to investigate?" And they're telling everybody what a good job they've been doing investigating. Are England as bad as all that at penalty shootouts? Well, that's an important piece of investigation, isn't it? Are England, is that actually English, Mike? I'm not convinced it is.
Not sure.
Did MPs reject the idea that animals can feel pain? How will Meghan Markle become a UK citizen? So this is the scope of BBC's Reality Check, but they're inviting people to put into the page here what they think the BBC should be investigating. And we'd like to say to our audience, would you like to get onto that page and hopefully with significant numbers of people being to encourage the BBC Reality Check to be investigating what's happening to Melanie Shaw? I think this would be a very, very interesting exercise. Of course, there is a caveat on this page which says that the BBC has the right to choose whatever subject it wants out of those selected. But I don't think that we can lose, really, because either the BBC will do something and then presumably produce a whitewash, or it will simply ignore what I think could be thousands of requests that they investigate the abuse around Melanie Shaw. We will see. Well, we just end on this, sent in to me. This will not mean very much to quite a few of our viewers, but I suspect some will understand this. In the very early days, part of my work in Plymouth was to try and get a replica built of HMS Beagle. This is the Navy ship that took Charles Darwin on his voyage of discovery around the globe. And HMS Beagle was refitted in Devonport Dockyard before she sailed. She actually had a considerable contingent of local Plymouth and Devonport crew members. And there's quite a lot of history in the local communities. Well, all of that project was viciously squashed by the local authority and the development agencies in Plymouth. Difficult to understand at the time. This is when the first person approached me and said, "I think your problem is common purpose." But of course, we can now look back and see that nobody wanted this project because it was about creating jobs. It was about getting young people off the streets. It was about getting proper pride back into what had been a shipbuilding community. Well, the project was crushed in Plymouth. But this page from Wikipedia here is showing that the project was actually taken up in Chile and they have actually built the replica now. Wow. So a project which should have been pride of place in Devonport, Plymouth, crushed by the local authorities and the political agenda to close down communities. And where's that project been done? Chile. So I'm going to say well done to Chile for having the presence of mind to push the project forward. And I'm going to say to people in Plymouth, this is unfortunately what you get if we allow this vicious change agenda to be pushed through to a local authority level. Mm. We'll leave it there. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back same time tomorrow. Bye-bye. All right.